you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of March 27th, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. It's going to be a great episode because we've got a lot to talk about, and we have one of the panels that, well, we're emphasizing quality over quantity this week because I am joined by frequent Information Week contributor and longtime collaborator, Larry Loeb. Larry, welcome to Information Week Live.
Well, thank you, Kurt. It's great being here on ESPN. Oh, wait a minute. Wrong show.
Nice try. Nice try. We don't have a big highlight reels of Elite Eight dunks and heartbreak, but we do have a lot to talk about this week. You know, it's been for news of a lot of different sorts around the industry, and you know, I think we need to start with the continuing saga of the FBI and Apple and what has come out since last week when all of a sudden the FBI dropped the legal presence to Apple. It turns out that things were better than the FBI was letting on.
Yeah, that's fair.
To begin with, a journalist that both Larry and I know, Wayne Rash, who is based out of the Washington, D.C. area, has come out with a story that was published at eWeek that pointed out that the FBI, through existing contracts with forensics firms, had the ability to get into that iPhone all along. And just as telling, after they had spent weeks telling Apple and everyone else in the world that this was a one-time thing, that they would never use the software again, that it was only for this one phone, they almost instantly decided that they would start helping prosecutors in other places, that they would go off and the first one was a prosecutor in Arkansas who had requested help on not a terrorism case, but just a standard criminal case. And they offered their assistance to get in to that phone. It's one of those things that puts the entire story that they were telling into a most interesting light. And I think that story that they were telling, that they were only doing this for one time and that there was only one way to get it done, has kind of fallen apart. Larry, do you think that we have a problem with what the FBI was saying, or is it just folks like me in the media who are misreading what had been going on?
No, they were lying through their teeth. One of the things that was apparent to anyone who was technically able in this particular area was that they had totally and completely ignored a hardware approach, that they were focusing solely on the software, whereas the hardware approach seemed to be a much more productive one on the face of it. Why they went this way in the first place is a puzzler. They used up an enormous amount of credibility to have to basically eat their request after it was gotten it issued by a tame judge. It is now going to be assumed the next time they try anything similar, they're lying again based on their past records. Just 2 weeks before the initial request, the software request that was made to Apple, the DEA had done had used the same company and probably a lot of the same means to crack an iPhone. There may have been differences, but it seems to me someone in one of the sister government agencies should have sat somebody down and say, hello, this is how real boys do it. So does that answer the question in a roundabout way?
You know, I think it does, but now I've got a question for you, Larry, because you are our resident expert in a lot of these things. When you mentioned this hardware approach to getting it done, what kind of things go into a hardware approach to getting into to this iPhone?
Well, what you do is you take the output from certain chips. Don't let it go through to a, like a USB drive or some other offsite storage. When you've gotten to, say, the 9th and 10th, and on 10 it's going to all blow up and lock itself to death, you basically reload the program that's counting the keystrokes. Eventually, at some point, you will get it. The actual technique is called NAND mirroring. It basically means unflip one of the pins, watch the data coming onto it, make a copy, and reload it when you need it again. Not real hard.
Now,
I even wrote an article for Information Week that basically says just that.
Then we are going to recommend that everyone, once this broadcast is over, they go out and look for that. We'll try to have a URL in the online chat that goes along with this radio show. But now, here's the question I think that a lot of people will have. Since this is a known technique, does this mean that people should be worried that, you know, any neighborhood teenager who lays hands on their iPhone would be able to get into it? Is this the kind of technique that you know, the people down at the local hacking shop can easily use?
There are tools at the local hacking shop. There's a $200 USB reader, I think, out there that can do the same thing, which assumes that you know what you're doing and have physical possession of a phone, I might add. There's also, and it really depends at this point, what level of software that phone is running. The San Bernardino phone was running a version of the software, iOS 8, which was not as protected as iOS 9 is. Which is not to say that iOS 9 could not be cracked with the aid of something like this. But once you got in there, it's a little different. There's something called a secure enclave, where it should be harder. Not impossible, but much, much harder.
Well, it sounds like this is the sort of thing that, because it was so public this time, is going to echo through our discussion of privacy and surveillance for a long time to come. Now, I'm going to ask you to put on your special tinfoil prognostication hat and say, you know, is this the kind of thing that you see having an impact on both the ability for law enforcement and national defense agencies to get into devices and the relationship between the manufacturers and law enforcement in the months to come?
I think that Apple, which has done this 63 times before, about responding to a subpoena with some information, might have some second thoughts. I've got to tell you one thing, though. I was asked in 2015 the same question. At the time, I had an answer. I don't have 20/20 vision. Go on,
well,
Kirk. Add the years. Add the years.
Well, I will say that I'm not sure that that many of us have 20/20 vision any longer, but I think that I would tend to say that your prognostications are reasonable. I think that it is going to have, as a lot of people like to style it, a chilling effect on such things. And that's unfortunate because there are frequently legitimate needs for law enforcement with the proper subpoenas and judicial oversight to get into devices. And so the notion that there is any kind of antagonism between the technical community and law enforcement community is at best unfortunate. Well,
but you got to remember the FBI started it. They made claims they had no right to make. They made assertions about their powers, for instance, that are not justified by the law of the land. There's something called COLERA that was passed by Congress a while back that specifically talks about the rights of cell phone manufacturers. It addresses this issue. They sort of ignored that and said, oh, we got this law in the books from 1700. Let's use it, and we can get anything we want.
It is a fascinating thing, and it will be interesting to hear whether are any repercussions out of some of those claims that were made. You know, speaking, though, of groups, if not overplaying their hand, at least making mistake, I think that we've got to look at something that happened today. Of course, this radio show is being originally broadcast on April 1st. And the good folks at Google are fond of their April 1st pranks. And they released a number of them today, but one of them didn't turn out quite the way they had hoped. They put into Google Mail a button so that couple of things happened. If you clicked on the mic drop send, then it appended a little GIF file of a minion dressed as a queen dropping the mic at the end of your email message. And
is
then,
that a rap reference?
It is a rap reference, but that's not the best part. It then archived any responses to that email rather than showing them to you on your feed. And that's the piece that tended to get folks upset because they were using Google Mail for their business email. In one notable example, someone talked about being fired from a freelance position because they had mistakenly clicked on that mic drop send button when responding to an editor who was taken aback both at the mic drop and the fact that the writer did not respond to their queries after that. I don't know.
Who's going to tell Scott? Who's going to tell Scott this happened?
Well, to me, one of the things that this points out is that there is still an art to both designing user interface and using the user interface, because what they did was have a separate button. You could still send an email just like you always did without the mic drop, but the mic drop GIF, the mic drop send button was right next to the regular send button. And so people who apparently were in a hurry, people who were doing things more or less on autopilot, were clicking that button by mistake.
It probably violated Bruce Tagazzini's rules of simple interface design.
I'm sure, having seen the screenshot, I would tend to agree with you because it had, even though they did not look exactly the same, they were different colors, and the mic drop send had a different set of characters on it. It looked different. They were next to each other, and they were the same shape. So you can see where someone who wasn't actually reading the interface for comprehension, as the teachers would say, might just click on the first vaguely rectangular button that came into eyesight and send something off.
The button inherited the usual interface from the situation. It wasn't bigger than the other button. It didn't scream its personage, and it was not intuitively obvious what was going to happen.
Yes, they really should have labeled it, click this button and you'll lose your job. I think that would have
yes.
ticked off more, you know, given more people an idea of what was happening.
Yeah.
Oh, good heavens. Well, this is, now I will say that I do think that one of their other April Fool's Day pranks was pretty good, and that was Google Cardboard Plastic, which is a clear plastic hood that you tape over your face in order to experience real reality.
God, get a startup going. We finally got real reality.
I think this has a lot going for it. I really do. And as you say, I can imagine somewhere in Silicon Valley, a few million bucks changing hands today for something exactly like that.
No, John Doerr left his VC post, so not going to happen yeah. today.
Well, let me ask you. I've come up with a couple of these. What big stories caught your eye this week?
I could get really nerdy on you if you'd like.
Oh, it's just the two of us. Let's nerd out today.
Okay. They came up in England. They came up with a quantum computing circuit. It takes something called a controlled swap, which is a logical operation, and they built like a gate. We're sort of at the way where, you know, there's TTL chips instead of hand wiring transistors and diodes to do the same logical function. Anyway, these guys came up with doing this controlled swap in one circuit that is scalable, I'm given to understand, as well as it feeds in to the stuff we were talking about last time I was on the show, about how quantum computing building blocks that are particularly well suited for solving the Shor algorithms have been, they figured out how to do them. So this thing, which is called a Friedkin gate, and I'm sorry for the heavy level of geekitude in this, but that's what it's called. The fact that they did it at all just sort of says not only is quantum coming, it's coming faster than you thought. That is something that's going to have a huge impact, I think.
You know, it really will, and I think it's probably something that ties in with the discussion we just had, that one of the first ways people are talking about using more common quantum computing is to brute force their way through encryption. I've seen a number of articles in the last week or so about just what the availability of quantum computing could do for the kind of encryption that is considered unbreakable today. Is that where you see one of the main uses being?
Oh, yes. The whole premise of an RSA style of encryption where two prime numbers are factored and coded and jumped up and down, is that to go the other way, to decrypt what those two prime numbers are, is a mathematically intensive and very long operation. If you take an engine that is designed just to do this sort of thing and you let it loose on a stream of encryption, it might be able at some point to come up with those prime numbers, which is why the NSA said in January, federal government, would you please not use that stuff anymore? They knew this was coming, you know? They knew it was real. And at some point, even the archives of all that classified information that's encrypted with stuff, somebody could go steal it and decrypt it, for heaven's sakes. Easy. Well, not easy, but it's not as hard as it used to be. That's going to be something a lot of people are going to be paying attention to.
Now, with these newer advances in quantum computing, I know that the idea of a quantum computer on your desk is something that's not in the current realm of possibility, but are we talking about quantum computers that could live in something that's closer to a standard data center rather than just in the heart of a research facility somewhere?
You're not thinking big enough, Kurt. I'm going to have to up your game here. Think of Watson. Think of Watson. Do you care where the machines that run Watson are?
No.
You got a speaker. You got Ridley Scott talking to the damn thing, and commercials being made. It doesn't matter what the machine is anymore. It doesn't matter where the machine is located. All the trends that we have been writing about for all these many years are converging. The cloud, faster data paths, excuse me, availability of services. My gut feeling here is you're going to see quantum as a service. It won't matter whose machine it is, except if they're listening into what you do, of course, but that's another question. It won't have to be on your desk. It's not like you're running an ASR33 teletype in the next room, where, you know, the PDP-8 had to be, or the PDP-11 had to be sitting right next to you to be able to give it input. No. We got the interwebs now, boy. We can shovel data all over the place.
It is, and it seems like the sort of thing that would very easily be something that both security researchers and people doing research in a lot of other areas, from climate to fluid dynamics to research, would all be lining up to buy time on.
I think they would too. We're back to, you know, Dartmouth time-sharing machines, except it's a bigger machine.
Now, I think the question becomes, are we finally seeing the sort of thing that is the final point of the famous statement by Watson, T.J. Watson, that he could see a need for no more than about half a dozen of these computers in the world? Do we only need a few, or do you think there are going to be a bunch of them in some sort of competitive quantum computing marketplace out there?
At the beginning, there will be very few of them because they'll be incredibly expensive to build and incredibly expensive to maintain operational conditions. That cost will lead to an economic imperative to get a revenue flow going for it. You know, who's going to pay the bills? Well, the users. Now, of course, just like the internet is today, where we sell our our personal preferences and data in return for services, one can only wonder what these quantum people are going to get in return. There might be all these fluid dynamic people using the machine, but then who's ever got the quantum machine can just read what you're doing and read what you got.
Very
Have I scared
good.
You?
No. I think this is exciting. I'm one of these people who loves the idea of greater power and loves the idea of it being more widely available. When I hear something like this, all I can think of is what kind of science fair projects kids will be able to work on in 20 or 25 years.
It might take that to have the eighth grade kids have it available. That'll be already second or third generation machines where people that are not funded by three-letter agencies spent some money to build one. Maybe they iterated again and found a better way to do some things. But those are the people that are going to want to sell to the eighth grade kid for his 50 cents in the Snickers bar, you know, when he's trying to analyze what happened when the volcano blew up. It's going to take a while for that to happen.
Well, at least we have something to look forward to. And with any luck at all, it will be ready in time for me to fulfill Sheldon's vision from Big Bang Theory, to have my consciousness uploaded into the cloud for permanent residence there at some point.
Well, don't forget Avatar 2, the sequel. Well, we'll see what happens if there's corruption in Gaius.
Another something to look forward to.
I'm telling you, I'm just so full of things to look forward to these days.
A visit from Mary Sunshine, you are. Well, I do want to get us, as we get towards the end, I do want to turn around and look at something that's a little brighter and something that I know a lot of people thought would never happen. Microsoft's Build conference is just ending. And at Build, Microsoft announced a number of things, but one of them, and I think one of the more surprising things, was when they announced that you can now run the Ubuntu Bash shell natively on Windows 10. And I think that the mere notion of being able to run an open source interface on the Windows NT kernel in something that is approved by and made available through Microsoft is just astounding. What's your take on that?
They're trying to keep Windows 10 relevant no matter how you want to use it. They put the lipstick on it, you know, but it's still the same bacon underneath it. They're doing it to get Windows 10 utilized. It's not a stupid way to go, because it may increase who wants to use it, but it's being inclusive of code that may have already been developed or used or known, but it all runs on Windows.
Well, I do think it's fascinating, and I did a piece for Information Week yesterday on this. To me, one of the keys is that this provides another way for the alpha geeks to use Windows 10 machines. These are the people who are the real power users, the people who are the sysadmins, the people who are the security researchers, because those are the people who tend to live in a bash shell. somewhere, people who are who live typing commands into a Linux, you know, at the end of a Linux prompt. And they have been using the Macintosh heavily for a number of years because the Mac allows them such easy access to a, to the Bash shell. I mean, if you have a Mac, you just fire up terminal, type Bash, and you're right there. And now Windows 10 will allow the same sort of functionality. This isn't a huge market. I mean, there are only so many of these folks around, but I think it's a hugely influential market. They're the people who a lot of other users see sitting, you know, typing into a dark screen on their laptops in the company cafeteria or at coffee shops and go, well, if the computer is good enough for them to use, it's got to be good enough for me. And so to me, that's a big piece of it. That, and of course, the developers who Microsoft is still chasing for its, you know, universal applications. They are still looking to grow the Windows application store. And I think this is another way of to try to attract developers who can do that.
Also, they are really, really trying to not become irrelevant. And I agree with you. They're trying to get the alpha geeks in on it because they say, look what we got for you. Of course, my thought is sort of technical on this. I'd want to see the libraries they use. It's not so much the Bash interface that's the problem. It's the same thing that happened to OpenSSL. The libraries that you depend on may be good, bad, or indifferent. And if those libraries are going to be maintained by Microsoft, not just after the first revision, but as they change, that's going to be a big thing for them to do. If they don't do it, all the people in Bash are going to be screaming their heads off. You know?
Well, I think it's interesting because one of the things that they have done with this, and in my article I post to a video of a demo of this, they are actually using all of the libraries and all of the code that is that will run under Ubuntu on the Intel processors will run here. They've simply swapped out the Linux core for the Microsoft NT core. And the same they claim that all of the libraries, all of the programs, everything, you can run GCC and compile a C program, and what it produces is not a Windows executable, but a Linux executable. And it just runs happy as can be. And, you know, their point is that this means that the entire open source community continues to be able to develop for the Ubuntu, and it will work under Windows 10 just as well as it does under Ubuntu's release. It's going to be fascinating to see how all this works out. As you point out, it's a major change. It's a major redefinition of what relevance means for Microsoft. And I'm looking forward to see if this in 12 to 18 months' time is considered to be a really big deal or just a blip.
It depends how Ubuntu maintains. If they've got Ubuntu to give these Bash programmers all the updates they need that may be tailored for Windows 10, it'll work. You know? They'll have what they need. But, I hope it's not a big porting job for the Ubuntu folks from what they're used to actually making it work in Win 10.
Agreed. It's a different level for both of them. It's one of those stories I think I've got to go and see if I can ask some real questions of the folks over at Canonical, because there's got to be a great story here.
Yeah, go do it.
Well, if I'm going to do that, I'm afraid I'm going to have to get off the air here, and we have just about run out of our time here on April 1st. But before we go, Larry, you've got to ask, what kind of stories do you have your eye on for the coming week? And where can people find you on social media to know when those stories are available?
I generally use the Tweety Pipe, Larry Loeb, L-O-E-B, on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn, all those kinds of social media. And whatever I come up with will generally get posted there, so just follow me all over the place. And I'll keep you up to date on what I'm looking at. Right at this point, there's nothing huge around the corner, you know? But I'm sure there's going to be something Monday morning.
That's one of the great things about our industry. There's something pretty much any given Monday morning that comes along. And I want our listeners to know that if they don't follow Larry, you really should. I have known Larry for a long time. He's been rooting around in this industry for a long time, and he's able to find great stories. So do yourself a favor, follow him on Twitter, and find out what he is learning about all of the deep, dark recesses of the computer industry. And Larry, thanks for taking time out of that spelunking to be with us today. We appreciate you being around the virtual table here in the studio.
That's fine with me. As long as you keep giving me coffee, I'll keep showing up.
You know I'm always good for a cup of Joe. Well, and as for me, I have a piece coming up on Information Week about Apple's 40th anniversary, which happens to be today, April 1st, 2016. And have a bunch of stuff coming up for the coming week, ranging from some news out of industrial 3D printing to some great user stories, all kinds of things going on. And to find out what I'm doing, please follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. I will let you know when pieces are up. Also want to let you know that we're coming up toward the big Information Week Elite 100 conference. Now, that is a meeting of CIOs and top IT executives from some of the most innovative companies out there. Now, this is taking place May 2nd and 3rd in Las Vegas, Nevada. This happens to be the same time as the first 2 days of Interop. It's going to be a great conference. I've seen a lot of the entries. I know who the finalists are. And we're going to be getting some radio shows with some of those finalists in the coming weeks. We'll be talking about those over at Information Week. So follow us over there. And be sure to keep your eye on those. There are going to be some interesting interviews with these CIOs and top executives. A lot of things you can learn. They're interesting people who have done fascinating things with IT in the last year. There's going to be a lot going on there. Well, for all of us at Information Week Live, thank you for joining us. I'm Kurt Franklin, your host. Hey, we'll see you next week.